Hello and welcome to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and tonight we look at what it takes to get to the top. But out of all the thousands of people I've interviewed, I have not found anyone who knows greatness that does not know failure, who has not fallen down. And tonight we can put that test, that theory to the test. But I just want you to know, if there's anyone out there who maybe life's not really going your way, perhaps you got fired from your job, or you basically lost your business, or anything that could be possibly happening in a very negative way, that these are really your greatest success moments. These are where your seeds of success are actually planted. And you can see that time and time again. Richard Branson failing out of school, Einstein thrown out of school, Steve Jobs fired from his own company, Elon Musk failing, dropping out of Stanford University. It goes on and on. You know, they did a study and they identified some of the key traits for being successful as a senior executive. And the more traits, the more of these 5, 6, 7 traits that you have, the more likely that you're going to be promoted. But what the actual catch is, that the more likely you will also be fired when the more of these traits that you actually have. So the fact is that, if you are falling down, it could be that, you're just inches away from making that big break. As one of my mentors always used to say, the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. So if you're in the shadow, it's because you have that light and you just need to push on through. But tonight we're going to test all these theories with people who really have made it to the top. And our first guest has been a chief executive officer, has run his own business. He's gone to Oxford. He's worked in several continents. He operates on a global level. His name's Sanjeev Gupta. He's a managing director for emerging markets, M&A, EMEA transaction advisory services for Ernst and Young. And following his performance, we also have a epic interview with Dr. Nasser Saidi, the founder and managing director of Nasser Saidi and Associates, the former chief executive of the DIFC. He is really one of the pillars of the Middle Eastern business community, and he's mostly well known to most people who've been out here. But if you don't know him, you're going to get to know him, and he's going to be giving us both his insights on rising to become one of the top economists in the region, but also potentially giving us some insight into what's going on economically and what's going to happen with that gas price, or what's going to happen with the local economy as we move forward. So that's definitely going to be an interesting interview that touches both on building your career as well as building a business, because he's an entrepreneur in his own right. And interestingly, both our guests have seen their careers transition between, very serious corporate roles and then on the other side, the antithesis to the corporate position, the very entrepreneurial master of your own ship role as well. So it should be quite interesting. But enough from me. Let's hear a little bit about our first guest, Mr. Sanjeev Gupta.
Sanjeev Gupta has lived and worked across the emerging markets of Africa, the Middle East, and India over the last 25 years. He is the leader of Ernst & Young's emerging markets M&A practice across Africa, the Middle East, India, Central and Eastern Europe, with a specific focus to deliver an innovative, integrated offering of Ernst & Young's technical and sector expertise to cross-border transactions in these markets. Sanjeev was previously the CEO of South African financial services giant Sanlam Investment Management's emerging markets business and the managing partner of Emerging Opportunities Consulting, a firm he set up to focus on working with fast-growing, consumer-facing, family-owned businesses looking for strategic and financial support. Sanjeev Gupta is a fellow of the Indian Institute of Chartered Accountants, a member of the Investment Analysts Society of South Africa, and holds an MPA from Said Business School, University of Oxford in the UK. His hobbies include writing on business and macroeconomic trends and playing golf. He enjoys presenting papers and is an active public speaker in various forums.
It sounds like this gentleman may not sleep very much. Chartered accountant, an MBA, writer, and somehow he fits golf into the equation. Mr. Sanjeev Gupta, welcome to Eye on Careers.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm surprised you found time. You know, that bio is quite full, you know. They say that the saying, you have ants in your pants, can't sit still.
Yeah, my wife might agree with you.
Well, I don't know if we can talk to your wife about what's in your pants on the radio, but so you're kind of like a slow rock fan, right? Eagles, Billy Joel, John Denver.
Yeah, shows my age, doesn't it?
So tell us, you know, what a career you've had. It really drifts across several areas, which most people work an entire career just to get to, and you seem to drift and weave seamlessly from CEO positions to entrepreneurial roles to, you know, playing a team role in one of the largest corporations in the world, Ernst & Young.
Yeah, I think probably the common link across all this is basically a curiosity about people. It's about trying to understand what's going on and inherently believing that somewhere you could probably play a role. I think it stems from an appetite to do something that is out of the ordinary, without making it sound very profound, of course. But it's about not following routine, if you know what I'm saying, Shane.
Yeah, I think that one of the big trends that people try to do is they look at past career paths and they try to follow it. Where, you know, when we look at your career path, it seems like you really followed your inner voice and, you know, didn't necessarily go with the tried and tested route.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you use the word inner voice. I hear that a lot these days, and I'm not entirely sure what an inner voice is, because if you were to hear it, Shane, as I hear it very often, it says very many different things at different times of the day. So it's not about the inner voice. I think it's about somehow being sort of agile enough to move, being happy enough to take on something that you're not used to. It's about, as I said, the curiosity to find out more. And it's probably, if I look back at the last 25 years of my working life, it's really about wanting to matter to people. I think people who are close to me, my friends, my family, they'll perhaps agree when I say this, that I just love people. I love partying. I love meeting people. I love going out with people. My work, fortunately, has been about meeting people.
Right. So how did it all start? You were born in Calcutta.
Yep.
And then what happened? You went to University of Calcutta.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's probably a little step back that will probably give you some perspective as to what shaped me. I grew up in a little town called Durgapur, which is 200 kilometers from Calcutta. My father used to work in a steel plant. So I've grown up in a very small town, sort of very structured environment where one had to plan one's life, one had limited choices in terms of career, and one had to focus to matter. And one of the sort of enduring influences, I suppose, that little town gave me was that you were answerable because there was no place to hide. If you did poorly in school, if you did poorly in the cricket field, if you beat up a little boy on the side, if you lost your temper, if you chased a girl, everything somehow the parents would know. So you had to take responsibility for your action. And I think when I look back, by default, that was an enduring influence.
Sure. So maybe you could just give us like a 2-minute overview before we cut to the commercial of kind of what your career path was and some of the key milestone moments in your development.
Well, you know, as you saw from my CV, I went to Calcutta University, did my Bachelor of Commerce, did my Chartered Accountancy, and then I was doing my articles with Pricewaterhouse, and in their wisdom, or probably because they didn't know what to do with me, they sent me to a little country called Botswana. And this was in the year 91, when at least my school map those days did not show where Botswana was. But I went there and I found a whole new world in terms of an environment which was changing, where lots of good things were happening. The global media hadn't picked that up. business was good. And as a youngster, one had the opportunity under a brand name like Price Waterhouse to make a big difference. So that was a fantastic opportunity for a youngster right out of school. And that's what sort of started my, interest in changing environments, in working in emerging economies, in wanting to meet more people, in trying to understand why policies happen. And that kind of led me to my next role, which was with this South African group called Sanlam, where I ended up running their African operations to start with, and then headed up their corporate strategy in terms of their business development and vision to build businesses across emerging markets. So that, again, put the base, if you like, Shane, to my sort of abiding interest till now in terms of wanting to do business in emerging markets. Then I left Sanlam because I had this little, some sort of a urge or an itch that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I wanted to work with entrepreneurs. So I set up a little boutique, which basically meant that I worked with family-owned companies, first-generation entrepreneurs, and I helped them to build strategies, helped them to rationalize their companies, and helped them to go into new markets. Did that for 3 years, and then one thing led to the other. Ernst & Young and I started talking, and at that stage, Ernst & Young wanted to set up this unit, which would act as a glue across their various regions. Found it very interesting, thought it was a great opportunity to work under a big brand, so I kind of gave in and came back to the corporate world. So that, in a nutshell, is my little trip.
And where did you do your MBA? I mean, at what point you did your MBA?
That was in the year 2009 when I was granted a bit of sabbatical from my employer then, Sanlam.
Okay, so, but at a certain point you jump, so you're at PwC, and then when you join Sanlam, you jump into the CEO role. That's where you...
Now, I wish I could say that. Obviously, there was a grind involved because after I left PwC, I joined as a lowly financial manager in one of the subsidiaries of Sanlam. And as I said, that it opened my eyes and mind up because Africa, sub-Saharan Africa in the 90s and in the early 2000s were a very exciting place to be.
Sure. How do you go from a lowly finance manager to CEO?
I suppose patience and a lot of stamina, I think. No, I think I was lucky. Lucky because, I suppose luck plays a role in everybody's life. But when you're young and you're curious, as I said, and you're hardworking and you're not scared and you want to travel to places that people would otherwise think twice, and you had a great brand like Sanlam supporting you, the world for a while was my oyster, where I could travel to any part of Africa, could do things that I wanted in terms of the business. So it was very easy, if you like, Shane, to make a little mark in an otherwise fairly large and bureaucratic organization. It's a bit like, I suppose, in the olden days, if you wanted to make a mark in the British system, you would go out into the colonies, wouldn't you? So that when you came back, you had some war stories to share and become famous for it.
So you believe that one of the top strategies someone can use is really leveraging the pioneering emerging markets as a venue for taking on larger scope, larger span of control, more responsibility. Because on the flip side, some people can say, going into the emerging pioneering markets, you may never return. And it could be the end of your...
Oh, well, Dr. Livingstone, I suppose. Yeah, no. Look, I think it's all about circumstances, isn't it? That if I look back, the 90s and the 2000s that made Africa, that made India, which is a market I worked in as well, it could have easily boomeranged. These economic revival stories may not have happened. So the attention that I gave, the focus I gave... the kind of commitment I gave to these markets and the passion that I had to make things happen could have easily boomeranged. So no question. So I don't think there's a formula that just because you want to succeed in a large organization, you somehow go into the sort of off-beaten path and make it happen. People do make themselves a success by working in the mainstream. So I think it's about you and what makes you happy. I've been fortunate, I think, in the sense that I was just telling my nephew, whose 20th birthday it was yesterday, and I was just saying that, find something to do that you like doing, and you will probably not believe that you have ever worked in your life. And I think somewhere I found that elusive formula, by accident, I might add, not by design.
This is the story of Sanjeev Gupta, and he's a managing director with Ernst & Young in the transaction services for EMEA. We're going to be finding out about the biggest challenge he's ever faced in his life in just a minute.
Dubai Eye 103.8. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we're listening to the story of Sanjeev Gupta, Managing Partner for Emerging Markets, Mergers and Acquisitions, EMEA, Transaction Advisory Services for Ernst & Young. This gentleman is a veteran of the pioneering and emerging markets of Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. He has an MBA from Oxford. He's a chartered accountant. And he's been a chief executive officer of some very large firms in Africa, as well as leading his own business, a boutique strategic advisory firm in Africa as well, before joining Ernst & Young. This is his story and his insights on running a business effectively in this region. So, welcome back, Sanjeev.
Thank you.
And so when we were looking at, you know, some of the roles you've had, and, you know, you've ran businesses, you've started businesses, you've advised businesses, what's been the biggest challenge you've had to face in your career so far?
I think one of the biggest challenges has been, having worked most of my life in Africa, is to be able to know who to trust. And when I say that, I don't mean that Africa can't be trusted. But what I mean is that, unlike other more sophisticated environments where there is much more data, much more sort of third-party confirmations, much more reference points, in sub-Saharan Africa, especially in the period that I worked in, I and probably because I was also young and trying to, you know, earn my own stripes, I had to sort of spend more time trying to make sure that the people that I want to do business with understood me and I understood them. So that used to be quite challenging, because it used to cause stress in my life, because very often I would visit somebody, come back, and not quite sure whether we could proceed with them.
So a lot of it was a value judgment, you know, on business. So, you know, it's not really whether the deal's good or not, but really whether this is someone you would, you know, bring home to your house for dinner.
Yeah, and also deals. You know, remember, you're talking mid-90s in Africa, when sub-Saharan Africa was just waking up to a capitalist way of doing things, where financial markets were just beginning to happen, where private sector was just beginning to rise. So even deals, even looking at opportunities, even trying to make sure that the financial models, the valuations, the growth story, the implementation plan, the infrastructure that is required to support such strategies would be in place. You know, sub-Saharan Africa was probably a place where one learned, but one learned as one worked. There were not too many textbooks to rely upon and not too many reference points, as I said. So, yeah, but the other problem is, well, not so much a problem, because I think it was very exciting, is that you had a rare and a unique opportunity to work with some serious entrepreneurs. Some of the entrepreneurs that I worked with are actually household names in Africa today. But they were people just like you and me, ordinary people with common ideas, but a hell of a lot of stamina to make things happen. So that was a lesson and a half.
What was, you think, you know, working with some of these phenomenal entrepreneurs that you've had a chance to interact with, what do you think your biggest learning from these individuals is?
I think one of the biggest learnings, and I don't know whether it's a learning or more of an observation, is follow your instincts. I think no school, no college teaches you that ultimately most entrepreneurial or most brilliant decisions, whether in the sort of in peace or in war, that man has ever made, is by following their instincts. That's probably why Churchill was such a great war leader, if you want to think about that. So what I saw across Africa, the bunch of entrepreneurs who made things happen, is they believed in their instincts, they moved the barriers, they changed things, and they worked bloody hard for it.
What do you mean by move the barriers?
Well, you know, again, go back to what I said, that some of these countries, some of these industries, were not ready for private sector. So when entrepreneurs
saw an opportunity, they had to actually go and move barriers like policies, like laws, make politicians understand, make global investors believe in them, which was a big mental barrier, where global investors were not really keen to invest in some of these sectors. You know, when you think of being an entrepreneur in a place like the US or the UK or Europe, you're ultimately selling your idea, but the environment is generally very facilitating. But in these sort of markets, what one saw was that you had to create the environment in the first place for a sector or for an industry to even be able to be born.
It takes a lot of energy.
Yeah, and a lot of conviction.
So the biggest challenge you face in your career is really making sure you're on the same page, both from a communication and a value perspective, with the person on the other side of the desk.
Yeah, yeah, and that's why you need to spend more time with them. You almost had to be their friend, if you like. I mean, I still do, but those days it was quite common for me to get calls from people at midnight, where they would actually say, "Hey, Sanjeev, I've just had this idea. Let's talk about it." And it was the nature of these markets where one had to be spontaneous. So it was good fun, I might add.
And what's your take on Africa now? I mean, a lot of people are saying the Africa story, you know, is going to be the holy grail of business, you know, in the 21st century. Other people are saying, you know, it's a good place that, you know, you may have a negative experience. I'll just run the radio because, you know, this, they're definitely not the safest, you know, by, you know, it may be a bit more dangerous than say the US or UK, as you mentioned. But then again, the UK, maybe the US has one of the highest, I'm digging a hole for myself. What's your take on Africa?
Yeah.
There was no way out of that one. It was going south.
That was a pretty big trouble you were using.
I know. It was just, I just stopped. But what's your take on Africa? That's what I just wanted to say.
I'm biased, Shane. I mean, and it's not just Africa. I think all the emerging markets that I worked in, I'm very biased. I'm biased because the emerging markets have one big thing going for them, and that's the energy of its people. I cannot define it. You got to go there and feel it. You got to go to a street in Lagos to see for yourself the energy, the vibrancy, the complete optimism that actually thrives in that street.
Complete optimism.
Yep.
Because a lot of people feel it's a bit dangerous, no?
Well, you know...
Is it safe? So you're saying it's safe?
No, I didn't say that. I said that the global perspective, which very often is influenced by the global media, is not always accurate, number one. Number two, that regardless of what the global perspective is on some of these markets, the sheer vibrancy of these people is going to make sure that these countries operate and operate well. And the evidence is out there. You know, we all grew up listening to sort of, you know, horror stories about genocide in Rwanda or the famine in Ethiopia or the military dictatorship and its excesses in Nigeria. But when you go there, you see only progress. You don't see famine in Ethiopia. You don't see genocide in Rwanda. You don't see gun-toting soldiers shooting you in Lagos. That's progress. That's not being reported enough. Same with India. I mean, the India I grew up in, which was in the late 80s, early 90s, was a pretty dismal place. It was wrong in terms of what it wanted to do for itself. It was discouraging to young people. Infrastructure was creaking. The laws did not allow entrepreneurship. But look at what the people achieved in a space of 25 years. So you got to believe that in emerging markets, it's not the global perspective which will change things. It's those people and their optimism that will change things.
The spirit of Africa will trump its dark moments.
I think the spirit of people, not just people in Africa, Middle East, we saw that a couple of years back, what simple people with simple views could do in terms of bringing change.
So your take on Africa is, you know, the hot spots are, you know, the usual suspects, you know, Lagos, Accra, and so on, or do you have a different perspective for us on, you know, kind of what are the key markets to watch in Africa?
Well, you know, it's not rocket science. It's the old 80-20 rule. Probably 7 or 8 countries in Africa make up 90% of the story. So yeah, I can't argue with the examples that you gave, Shane. It's really about getting things right in Nigeria. It's really about getting things right in
Kenya, in Tanzania, Uganda, Ethiopia, and you can get things right. Good business is thriving there. There are certain tricks, there are certain nuances, there are certain lessons, but then, you know, what's different?
So do you have any, I mean, you've really a master of running professional service firms at this point, from running, you know, mom and pop shops to large conglomerates. What you know, would you say are some of kind of the North Stars for you when you look at running a services business?
Well, you know, I'm not entirely sure whether I got your question, but I'll try and answer it nevertheless my way. If you're telling me what do I look for in terms of what might succeed and what may not, if that was your question, Shane, then it's pretty simple, isn't it? That businesses are made by people, right? And strategy in itself doesn't create businesses. It's the ability to execute that makes businesses. So when you work, when you advise, when you try and support any entrepreneur or any corporate with their decision making, you try to go behind the blue sky stuff. You try to go behind the rhetoric. You try to go behind the corporate announcements. You actually try to test the state of readiness in terms of the management skills, in terms of the technology, in terms of the product quality, in terms of the infrastructure that supports the business, to then start believing that this business can do what it's going to be doing or what it says is going to be doing, and you can support it. See, as a professional firm, one of the things we try to do, and obviously we don't get it right all the time, is we do avoid situations where we just support a client or do some work for a client when we truly believe that the direction is flawed. It is our job, and we make it our job, to make sure that if we don't believe in something, that we actually point that out without blindly going and supporting it.
So, you know, your focus is really make sure you have the infrastructure resource in place to execute.
Yeah, and if you don't have it, plan for it. I mean, it's again, you'll be surprised that if you know where your deficiencies are, and it's not impossible to find out if you're honest to yourself where your flaws are, where your gaps are, it is easy to fix them. You know, as I say, you can't fix what you don't know. So half the fixing starts with the knowing, and half the knowing starts with the humility to accept that you don't have everything. You can't have everything.
This is Sanjeev Gupta, managing partner with Ernst & Young, giving his insights to strategy and tactics in the pioneering and emerging markets of Middle East Africa. We'll be more on him in just a minute.
Dubai Eye 103.8, keeping you up to date with what matters in the UAE. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. We're talking with Sanjeev Gupta, managing partner for mergers and acquisitions for EMEA Transaction Services with Ernst & Young. Sanjeev, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you.
So we were just talking a little bit about you know, what it takes to be successful in these markets. What are some of the key things to look at? And I guess one of the things you were pointing out was, you know, execution is really key. And to me, you know, that's really breeding tactics, you know, tactics over strategy in the pioneering markets, you know, where you have these more stable markets of the West. Maybe you have 1 year or 2 years to sit out and make a plan and do a go-to-market strategy. Whereas, you know, I find that kind of the modus operandi of the emerging market entrepreneur is, hey, let's take a kick at the can and see what happens, and if it doesn't work, rip it down and put it back up. Well, that's what they do in real estate anyway. I don't know. But what's your take on that? I mean, you know, in a sense, is the Western uber sophisticated entrepreneur even in fact at a loss when he comes to the Middle East, because, you know, part of his toolkit's irrelevant? Obsolete?
No, I don't think the toolkits are obsolete. But, you know, I might say, Shane, you're quite biased in terms of this particular line of questioning, where you have already assumed, and you're making your listeners assume, that somehow it's the Wild West out there. It isn't. You know, business is serious, and it is serious business that's happening there. And I think far too often, because of the nature of emerging markets, which by definition tends to be volatile, tends to change because laws are changing, new paradigms are coming in, necessitates an entrepreneur to be very nimble. And when I mean nimble, he's nimble to the point where he does U-turns too, where he realizes that the path he was following has no future. And that can sometimes be seen, Shane, to be, he's erratic, he just took a shot in the dark, he didn't quite believe in his strategy. It's not true. It's because you're operating in a very uncertain set of circumstances with far too many factors, which is beyond either your understanding or beyond your control. You, to survive, you've got to somehow be very nimble. That doesn't mean that he's being silly, and that doesn't mean that he's not being committed. Ultimately, he's following a strategy, but he's also man enough to know that he has to learn at every step that what he was expecting may not exactly be the case. And that's why I think the beauty of doing business in emerging markets is it's around being not only nimble, as I said, but being very agile. And that's probably why your question about are the rules different is perhaps relevant. Because large corporates, when they tend to come into emerging markets, they tend to come with fairly rigid views about how things should happen, which products should be sold, what distribution should take place. And unfortunately, large corporates, with their large centralized management systems, are never locally present enough to make those quick decisions. So very often, they regret their decision to come into these markets, and then they basically justify it by saying, that was a tough market, nobody follows any rules, that's why we pulled out. While for the local entrepreneurs, it's their survival. It's their market, so their knowledge is deep. So they do tend to beat the large corporates in their own game.
Right. I mean, if we look at the real estate boom, for example, and look at some of the people who really made big money, a lot of these people were just tactically strong. Hey, let's buy the house. The price is going up. Let's sell it. Hey, it went up another 30%. Let's sell it again. Let's buy another one. And then, these individuals who were highly sophisticated, and they started doing analysis, and they were like, there's no actual end user. And if you look at this, this is a bubble and it's going to explode. And then so they don't actually participate, or they wait too long to participate. And the people who are actually just going by the seat of their pants are the ones who cashed out hugely. I mean, I literally met one individual who bought and sold the same house 5 times and became a millionaire. I mean, I can't get more simple than that. He said he felt like he won the lottery, and there was literally no strategy. I mean, I just think, and maybe I could be wrong, it's just my humble opinion, that the West puts too much emphasis on strategy. And when you actually look at the bulk of the self-made millionaires, that these guys did not sit there and use Porter's Five Forces and, did a whole strategic analysis. They basically sold blue widgets, and then they sold more blue widgets, and they said, hey, these are selling, let's get a container load of them. And they made their money.
Shane, just a question. Which side of the property market did you sort of feel, the receiving end or the rewarding end?
As soon as I got off the plane, I put my foot on the ground and GDP dropped by 50%.
Good Lord.
So I have to apologize to everyone out there for that. But, I'm a headhunter, so I actually don't, I've talked to the people before and after the fact. During.
No, because, it's funny, you talked about the property industry and particularly the sort of stuff that happened in this region and kind of try and make that a proxy argument around strategy and lack of strategy. I mean, what we saw in the property industry is nothing different to what we have seen in every part of the world, including developed markets, which is from time to time, you will see Ponzi schemes where basically, it's a case of who leaves last and who is smart enough to leave while there is still demand. The property market here was a giant Ponzi scheme in many ways. So was Madoff's scheme in the US. So, you know, we are now getting into a very different topic, which is about human greed, about herd mentality, about thinking that if he can do it, I can do it. That's not what we are talking about when we're talking business. So if you can just move away from clearly an area which has affected you in many ways, Shane.
Okay, let's get back to, you know, basic business. You look at a steady state economy,
yeah,
where, you know, your investment in capital stocks not going to move the GDP curve. So they say, let's lead through innovation. And this is the mantra of the U.S., of, you know, these kind of more modern economies. Mm. They need to be innovative to move their GDP curve. When you come into the emerging markets, you know, an investment in capital stock, you build X number more factories, you're going to move your GDP curve. So just by definition, the leadership dynamic is completely different. We don't necessarily need to lead by innovation, you know. So you know, right out of the gates, you look at guys like Kobon.com. They copied Groupon. You know, you look at SukaoMall.com. They copied Money Supermarket. You know, it's not necessarily, you know, the crux of the emerging market that we need to be the innovative strategic leaders.
Yeah, but you know, I'll say a few things there. Firstly, strategy for the sake of strategy is not something anybody does, whether it's in the developed markets or in the emerging markets. The second thing you must remember is that some of these markets, the emerging markets, tend to be less complex, tend to be less competitive, tend to be more rewarding the first-time entrepreneur because the sector has just opened up. So obviously you don't need much of strategy. The third thing you must remember is that it is a benefit to some of these emerging markets that they came to the party a little later. So there are lessons that they can learn from the developed markets and apply it. I mean, any smart guy would do it. But having said all that, that yes, it is good that you can copy other people. Yes, it is good that the markets you're operating in is much less complex. And it is good that sometimes just a change in law or a change in policy opens a huge opportunity. And the first time somebody realizes it, makes a lot of money. All that being true, you cannot dismiss the fact that enough innovation keeps happening in emerging markets. There are case studies for it. Look at Kenya, where the mobile phone company Safari.com, they basically became what is now a pioneer in terms of mobile phone-based payment collection system, which now the banks across Africa are using, and developed market banks are actually thinking of applying the same technology. Now, why did that innovation happen? Because there was a need. So similarly, if you go to India, you see Unilever, this giant FMCG company. They realized that their future in India lay by being able to reach the masses. But they also realized that the mass market is not capable of paying for the price of the shampoo or the soap they were selling. So what did they do? They changed the volume or what you call the number of liters or milliliters that they would sell in a sachet as opposed to in a bottle of shampoo. Why did they do that? Because they realized that a villager out there does want to shampoo his hair, but when he earns a wage of 10 rupees a week, he cannot put 8 rupees into a bottle of shampoo, but he's happy to put 1 rupee for that day when he shampoos his hair. So what I'm really trying to say to you, Shane, is please do not think that innovation is not happening in emerging markets. It's happening all the time. Do not think that strategy is not happening in emerging markets. It's happening all the time. Yes, of course, markets tend to be less complex. So maybe we understand them better than we understand some of the more global corporates. But that is not to say that the usual principles of business don't apply.
So do you think this is one of the big opportunities of the 21st century as companies vie to take advantage of this mass population, the bottom of the pyramid, the individual that's making 10 rupees a day?
Correct. I mean, if you ask any large global corporate today, where does their growth strategy lie? They will tell you it's emerging markets. And that is because of the demography. You know, out of 7 or 7.5 billion people that the world has, close to 4, 4.5 lives in emerging markets. What is more interesting is almost 60 to 70% of those people are very young. They're below the age of 20. Africa, 1 billion people, 70% of them are below the age of 18. Now, you can say it's a curse or you can say it's an opportunity. The FMCG companies, the pharmaceutical companies, the mobile phone companies, the consumer financing companies, the food companies, they're all looking at it as a huge opportunity.
And do you think that's ever going to come online?
It is. The evidence is already out there. I mean, if you see any market in India or in Sri Lanka or in Southeast Asia, China, more recently, and Africa, of course, you will see that as compared to 5 years back, there is much many more global banks, much many more global insurance companies, much many more global food companies, much many more consumer goods companies, all trying to penetrate that market.
So, but, you know, it doesn't really seem like they're making money there yet.
Yeah, you see, they are making money. I don't think you can make that sweeping statement. But the more important point is that you got to accept that the size and the scale at which these companies will operate for some time will be nowhere near the size and scale that some of these companies already are in their own markets. So if you think of whether they will matter in the next 10 years, for example, for a Unilever, will Africa matter as a proportion of their global sales in the next 5 to 10 years? Maybe not. But should it matter? Yes. Why? Because whoever doesn't go into emerging markets over the next few years will live to regret it, because that's where the market is. That's where the growth is. That's where the demography is pointing you towards.
Sanjeev Gupta, managing partner for Ernst & Young Mergers and Acquisitions Transaction Services, his take on what it will mean to be successful in the Middle East and Africa coming up, his take on what an executive needs, what traits, what skill sets, what capabilities do you need to survive and thrive in this market.
Dubai Eye 103.8, award-winning news, business, sport, and lifestyle coverage. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we're here with Sanjeev Gupta, the managing partner for Mergers and Acquisitions, EMEA Transaction Services for Ernst & Young. Sanjeev, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you.
We were just talking about some of the opportunities in South Asia and Africa, Middle Eastern markets, where Sanjeev, you were saying 70% of the population in Africa is under 18. That's a huge number. You say that becomes increasingly interesting for anyone who wants to kind of play or roll the dice on the bottom of the pyramid business strategies for these pioneering markets. You yourself being, you know, having sat in the hot seat, the chief executive officer, commander in chief of some of these organizations operating in Africa, what do you look for when you're hiring for, you know, these kind of pioneering markets? And are there different traits that you think someone needs, you know, to have in this market versus operating in a more kind of stable state economy such as New York or London? Or do you feel that, you know, a top performer in any of the Western cities will also be a top performer in the emerging markets? I mean, maybe there isn't a difference. Is there or is there not? And what do you look for?
Yeah, it depends on which level you're talking about the recruitments that you refer to. Because if you're talking about basically recruiting young people at a graduate trainee level or a management trainee level, then fundamentally, I don't think there is a difference. I think fundamentally, young people all over the world with good qualifications or good degrees are probably aspiring for the same thing. And the good person that you would recruit in New York would not be too different to the good person that you would recruit in Lagos. You would still be looking for the same attributes, apart from the technical or the professional skills that the person has. You would look for an attitude that displays to you that the person wants to learn. You would try to look for an attribute in the person which tells you that the person's basically curious enough and going to be active enough to be wanting to do different things. You will want to see a person who can probably deal with different cultures, because, you know, this is a very important aspect that till probably say 20 years back, a global company sitting in New York could sort of get away by not having to have people who are culturally or internationally astute. But increasingly, we see that whoever you recruit in whichever part of the world, because the world is so globalized, you will always want people who have that cultural intelligence, if you like, in them, the ability to, or at least the interest, to understand other cultures and work across different cultures. So I don't think fundamentally it's very different.
What perhaps makes it slightly different when it comes to working in emerging markets is that what I've seen is that a lot of individuals with good degrees do not like to start their careers in emerging markets because they have this sort of a belief, which is perhaps justified, that the level of training, if you like, or the level of sophistication, if you like, or the level of access to knowledge that they will get will probably not be the same. So we do see hesitancy on the part of good graduates to come and start their careers in emerging markets. So therefore, when we try to recruit, or when I have tried to recruit people in emerging markets, I've tried to get that balance right between somebody who is perhaps more of a generalist, but likely to cope in a very uncertain generalistic type environment, as opposed to recruiting a specialist. Because in most emerging markets, being a specialist in a particular field, it can be tough to thrive.
So when you're hiring, is that what you look for? You know, curiosity, willingness to learn, or what do you personally look for when you're bringing someone onto your team? Do you have some, certain way you run your interviews? What do you look for?
I do. I mean, and that doesn't mean that that's the only way to do it or that's the right way to do it. I personally look for irreverence. I love young people these days. Honestly, I do. I think they're the most fortunate generation because they are armed with so much information. I won't say knowledge, but so much information that you can't tell them anything that they don't know already. They're so aware of the world in terms of what's going on. It's not the same. It wasn't the same 20 years back. Then because of the way the world has been, they actually genuinely feel that they're not out of place in any part of the world. So I actually envy the youngsters these days in terms of how they've started life and how comfortable they are. So when I interview people, what I try to see is not so much their comfort levels with different cultures or the education they've had or the fact that they know a hell of a lot of stuff. It's really about, do they have that little sparkle? Do they have that sense of humor? Do they have that irreverence, as I call it? I love irreverence. I love people talking back to me. And I think when you allow people to talk back to you, you actually sort of bring out the baser instincts of that person. And that can only be helpful when you're trying to assess a person. So that works for me.
So you want someone you want to be surrounded by no men, basically.
Yeah, I mean, if you see my children, you will know. I mean, I'm surrounded by no people.
So you know, I think, you know, you feel that kind of brutal honesty within a business, the ability to question your boss, really question tradition, is really going to be one of the critical things organizations need to continue to be relevant, continue to succeed in the 21st century.
Totally agree. I mean, I don't think there is a choice there, in my view. You've got to have people who, because, you know, information is no longer king. Everybody has information chain. It's what you do with it and how confident are you to apply that information and believe in your instincts to make those decisions. That's what's going to shape the future executive. There was a time when I was growing up when knowing something made you superior. It's no longer the case.
Right. Do you feel that maybe now, you know, some of these Eastern organizations, which have kind of more patriarchal structures, you know, are they kind of creaking? Are they fracturing under, you know, these new market conditions where, you know, you really need to have that free flow of information? I mean, you're probably one of the few senior leaders, you know, out here who encourages irrelevance, you know, as you said. So, you know, do you think that, you know, this is going to be a challenge for organizations, as, you know, we're seeing a complete paradigm shift in the type of leadership that's required?
I think that's a great question, because in a lot of the emerging markets, businesses are typically run and owned and managed by families, right? And families tend to be very patriarchal, as you said, very hierarchical, very authority conscious. So yes, I do see a lot of good quality family businesses floundering a bit, because either the younger generation is not being trained properly or they are not being allowed to do things that they should, given their superior knowledge and understanding of the world. And in most cases, certainly not being heard as much as they should be heard. So if you ask me, a lot of family-owned businesses with their first generation, second generation manager, family-owned managers or family managers, they need to start thinking much more laterally in terms of what will create the sustainability for them going forward. I agree with that.
But in a, but on the same time, it becomes almost impossible to change out your managers, because, you know, someone who's been with you for 20 years, who, you know, was there when your uncle passed away, or when your shop was burned to the ground, or, you know, there's, you've spilled blood together, you've scraped your knees together, you know, now you're going to turn around and say, well, you know, the business needs something else now. And, you know, and in a sense, you can definitely empathize with the, with a lot of these Eastern leaders who are just saying, you know, I'm sorry, but we're, this is just how it's going to be. And we're not letting this, these individuals go.
Yeah, it, it is. And I think what you're really saying is that loyalty is normally seen as a big attribute in being a successful sort of resource in a family-owned company. But just quickly, Shane, it's not just the old manager who has been with you for generations. It's also your children, you know, children of successful entrepreneurs. How do you firstly make sure that they deserve to be managing that business? And secondly, how do you make sure that if they do deserve to be managing the business, that they're allowed to manage that business as opposed to you interfering all the time? So it is a few things that one has to get sort of the balance right. Coming back to your question about what do you do with those old loyalists, I think at a certain time, point in time, all loyalists have to be thanked. But as you know, that you know, if you just want loyalty, get a dog. But if you really want performance, then sometimes you got to move on and get something other than a dog.
So you take talent over loyalty.
Well, you know, unfortunately, if you want performance and high performance and increasingly performance in a very competitive environment, just loyalty doesn't do it, does it, Shane?
But has the West taken it too far, you know, where you're saying, okay, we need results every week, every quarter, you know, we're driving it to the point where, you know, your quest to create value is almost destroying value itself?
I tend to agree with that, that that the measurement of performance and measurement of success has become so micro and has unfortunately also gone into the wrong hands, in the sense that the media or the half-baked analyst or the financial journalist is making too many judgments. And unfortunately, with the way media is, and particularly with social media, the ability of a half-baked person to move opinion against a company is so huge that it's disproportionate. So it is scary. And I think if you talk to senior leaders of large companies, the biggest fear is that, that this eternal scrutiny that they're being put under and the constant checking on everything they do and the misguided reporting that very often happens creates huge challenges in terms of reaching out and making your stakeholders comfortable. It's a challenge that corporate leaders have to face up to.
I saw one description of the digital age, and they said, you know, it's prime time, and the audience is running the show.
I wouldn't disagree. I'd hate to be a CEO of a large listed New York listed company, having everything under sort of, you know, sort of being scrutinized at any given time. It is a tough job.
Yeah, the seven-figure salary and the helicopter and the private jet. And
yeah, but
it's, I would hate that. I agree. I don't want that job.
But with all that, you can't still fly away. That's the problem.
Well, Sanjeev, unfortunately, we're coming up on time, but I could easily do another couple hours with you. So thank you so much for taking the time to share your insights with the pioneering and emerging markets with you. And we wish you all the best as you continue to spearhead your role with Ernst & Young.
Thank you very much, Shane, for the opportunity. Thank you.